This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 336, Pancaking Robots. Hello and welcome to GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin. I'm one of your co-hosts, and I'm excited to be joined by another one of your co-hosts, Mr. Michael Rowe. Michael, how are you today?
Hello. I am well. How are you?
I'm ready to play some games.
I'm ready to be at work. No. I'd rather be playing games.
I'm seriously ready to play some games. This is a long weekend, definitely needed. Looking forward to it. We will be posting this on Monday, as we normally do, but we won't be working that day. Hopefully, we will be playing games. So,
yes.
Let's start with the first one. And I tweeted about this one earlier today because I just thought it was super funny. We all know about the Ever Given and it getting stuck in the Suez Canal. And as I read about this, this reminded me so much of Desert Bus. And wouldn't it be cool if you're like, okay, you can pilot the entire Suez Canal in real time for using a big ship. In this case, they call it the Whatever, and for fun and profit. Wouldn't that be great?
I think that would be awesome. And yeah, I saw this too, and all I could think of was the Desert Bus and how badly I am at certain types of games, and I hope this is one of those, so it's even worse and more aligned to the Ever Given than a standard maze game.
Yeah, that'd be so much fun. And a shout out to Charlotte G for me, because I do read the MIT Tech news and tech review that she's authoring and assembling a whole bunch of fun stuff. And thank you for putting this one in my feed so I could check it out. So awesome. There's actually a couple from her material that you're going to show up today too. So Charlotte, way to go.
And you know, this is actually, it's a Steam game. So I wonder if it'll play on the Mac too, or only Steam for the PC. I'll have to check it out.
Well, if it's only Steam for PC, then it won't be me playing this game.
It says planned release.
Yeah, date. It's early. Yeah, it's still early.
Okay. So we're going to add it to my wish list.
There we go. Now there's another game experience, which actually reminds me of similar things that we've seen a couple of few times here. This is a coffee table game, but it's actually not a coffee table game. It's a coffee table that plays games with a screen on it. And the example that they use here is Monopoly, where you've got, you know, the lovely board. And I'm sure that it makes it really hard to cheat at Monopoly if you're trying to be a cheating banker, which I do not recommend. I also don't recommend this if you are a board flipper, because you'd be flipping the table and that would cause
a big mess. Which would be pretty expensive.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that either. But it was kind of a cool thing, and a coffee table with a screen. You would almost hope that you could do some neat things like AirPlay or the functional equivalent from a PC or something else to the table, so you could play a game that way that maybe doesn't come on it. Anyway, that was my thought.
Yeah, that would be cool. Matter of fact, it's another way. You know, they give Monopoly as the example, and Monopoly is one of those games that there are a gazillion versions of it, right?
Yeah.
And they're all the same game. The only thing they do is change some of the wording of the locations, right? Based off of Star Wars Monopoly or UNC Monopoly, or, you know,
or German Monopoly. I used to play German Monopoly.
Whatever. Yeah, I did too, right?
Yep.
And they'll change the currency. They change some names.
Sure.
But on the whole, it's the exact same game. So you could easily see a whole market of Monopoly games on this board, to where you buy the base game. Let's say it's $30. And then each incremental one is literally just the royalty difference that's paid to that organization whose branding you're using.
Yeah, there were a few of those that were like that. What didn't the Game of Life kind of operate that way? You could buy, you know, different themes of that, and, you know, like spooky Halloween version Game of Life, or I don't know.
I don't remember that with the Game of Life, but that would not surprise me.
Yeah, I think there's a few that operate that way, but you're right, and that's a good way to make a game that's been around for a while fresh, and remonetize it and extend the gameplay, right? Because it's a little bit more fun. And shoot, you could add animations. You could do all kinds of good fun stuff with that too.
Yeah, the Game of Life was my sister's favorite game growing up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh yeah. And we always had to play that.
Hmm.
Right? When all the siblings got together, that was the game that she wanted us to play.
Yeah, I remember there were playing that with people who were like, I don't want to get married.
Yeah, it's like, can I just skip that piece? Yeah, we'll or just, back up one?
Just keep going, right? But the little pegs in the car, that was always fun.
Yeah. It was amazing that the kids and the parents were all the same size.
Yeah, well, they grow up so fast.
You should
fast.
Have had little pegs. Anyway, but we digress.
Oh, we do. So let's digress to some drone action here. And Michael, you found an intriguing set of challenges and problems and fines that can occur if you are flying a drone around and get close to a landing airplane.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I've been following the Tech Dirt site for a while, and recently been slowly putting suggested links into the show, and I've been wanting a drone. I've been wanting a drone for years, and not a little crappy, cheapy one, but a good quality, high quality drone. And gosh, I can't believe it's over 2 years ago that I went to a demo session at a tech users group where a guy brought one of the, I think it was a DJI.
Yeah, one of the Mavic.
The higher end DJIs. And it was going through, you know, the different apps that you need in order to ensure that you're, at least in the USA, addressing the
your compliance.
Flight regulations, yeah. Et cetera, that you're not, you know, flying in the wrong areas, that you're in the right paths, that you're the right height, et cetera. And what's so funny about this story is really talking about the police in Canada using a drone and ending up flying into restricted airspace.
Oops.
And hitting a plane, which is the big fear on drones, is that they'll get sucked into the engine of a plane and cause catastrophic damage.
Mm-hmm. And, like a goose.
Depending on the, exactly. That's where I was going. But, you know, depending on the size, it could be more or less catastrophic. But when you're talking about a jet intake, that can be, you know, it doesn't have to be that big.
Yep.
Well, this one actually hit a small Cessna.
Mm-hmm.
And they then start going through the different legal fines that an individual could have and a corporation. And I started looking at this story mm-hmm. and trying to do a good calculation of what the police who are flying it inappropriately in an inappropriate location, whether by design or by accident, and then having rolled this up, and I was wondering, you know, they could probably buy a cruiser or at least a small cruiser for this, or a really, really nice drone for the fine that they're going to have to pay. I mean, a really, really nice drone. I just found it interesting to see this play out for all the reasons that they've been doing. I know, gosh, what was it, 4 years ago, there was a regulatory move in the U.S. Around the size and weight of a drone requiring a drone license. And right. That was pushed back. It was pushed back against pretty hard. But, you know, there's a reason for those types of things. And this is a perfect example of it, right? It's why you don't just let anybody drive a car, right? There's rules of driving on the road, and the fact that you have to take some training and learn the rules of the road, so to speak. So it's really interesting to see this story, and it kind of plays out a lot of the things that reinforce the need for certain regulation in my mind.
Well, and the exposure here too. I mean, the level of fines that this article specifies and that are stackable is pretty big. So for someone who flies a drone just recreationally, gosh, you need to know, don't fly it near an airport, because you could be $10,000-$20,000 in fines real quick. You know, not to mention putting lives at risk, which you don't want to do either.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I just, super interesting on lots of fronts. Now, we have another story that is kind of like that, but a little bit reversed. We've talked plenty of times about artificial intelligence and drones and structure about hitting humans, but here we have a story of a human that is going around a corner and hits a drone. Or not a drone. In this case, it's a little robot. That's a little delivery robot.
Well, it's a driving drone instead of a flying drone.
It's a driving drone. Yeah. and while the driver here only clips this little robot moving along, doesn't flatten it.
Who henceforth will be called Clippy.
And I was pretty amazed that this little robot managed to get itself back out of harm's way after getting clipped, because that implies that there's at least enough AI or programming in there that says, "Ooh, I've been injured. Get out of harm's way and get onto the sidewalk and out of the middle of the intersection." Thought that was pretty cool. It's going to be hard to see these all the time, right? Because they could operate at night, and maybe they have lights, and maybe they've got turn signals, and maybe they got a bunch of other stuff. But it's something you got to be even more aware of. And shoot, think about autonomous vehicles, Michael. The programming there has got to be looking not just for bicycles or other cars or just random obstacles like a log in the middle of the road, but you know, they've got these little robots that could be in the way too, like those mouse droids on the Death Star. You know, what if they're that small?
Let's talk about those little mouse droids, right? What was their purpose?
To go around and check and things out. They're probably IoT, you know, sensing
little
things.
Sensors. Yeah, right? You know, that's the other thing let's talk Star Wars briefly, because you know, it's Friday. You know, you have all this massive technology of the Death Star, right?
Yes.
And they can't identify where people are moving around on the Death Star, right? You've got all this technology, but a simple tracker doesn't exist for most things. But they can track a space. There's so many inconsistencies in these stories that I enjoy.
It's very easy to explain that. You know what it is?
It's in the script.
GDPR.
the Galactic Data Protection Regulatory.
Exactly. See? You got it precisely. That's what it was. It's privacy. You're not allowed to keep track of where people are on the Death Star.
The Empire was forward thinking.
They never rewrote the rules, so it was applicable.
That's amazing. Because it was a long time ago.
And
in a galaxy
far away.
Far, far away.
Yeah.
I thought this video was the video attached was pretty interesting, and you and I were discussing before the show, and even the article kind of calls out that it wasn't clear who was at fault,
right?
Because the drone is trying to cross at a crosswalk, but you see blinking above the drone's head, top, I don't know, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
The don't walk sign is blinking, which usually comes on at the end of the walk cycle to say, hurry up and get across if you're halfway or more across, but don't go into the crosswalk. And the car takes a right in front of it and clips it. So who was at fault? Was it the car for taking a right and not yielding to the vehicle in the crosswalk? We know that pedestrians had the right of way, but do robots have the right of way? Or was the car at the drone at fault for starting into the crosswalk at the beginning, during the cycle of don't walk blinking?
It was really on the verge, you know. On the verge.
I was about to say it was on the verge too.
Where I've replayed it a couple of times because I agree with you. It's like just on the border of the turning from the go ahead and walk, it's great, to don't walk at all, and it's hard to tell because the car cuts in front of it, so you don't see precisely where the robot is when the car nicks it. It's another set of important traffic considerations. And is a robot a pedestrian or is it a vehicle? Right? Because if it were a vehicle, it would have to be on the road and have the appropriate vehicular elements. And shoot, you know, look how small it is and look how low it is. You know, you're not necessarily looking down.
Yeah,
there,
I mean,
right?
I mean. It would be like an infant walking across the street.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the guy's in a big old SUV, right?
Yeah.
Way up. He's not going to, they are not going to see something that's well below the sight line of the vehicle.
Yep.
And so, again, I think it's the robot's fault because the robot has sensors to capture the fact that something's coming its way, the fact that it didn't react fast enough, maybe the programmer's fault.
Maybe so. I mean, there's a lot of interesting faults here, and not any of them earthquakey. But moving along, we've got a interesting listener, longtime listener tweet from Alexis, who is suggesting that Barca maybe have been able to hang on to Messi if they'd only been selling tokens around.
NFTs.
Yeah, NFTs, and just hung on to them that way. And shoot, you know, you could have done an NFT of, you know, some of the major scores that he's had, or, you know, key outfit, or, you know, who knows what, right?
It's funny because PSG, who picked up Messi from Barcelona, right, was they are including NFTs, or at least what they call cryptocurrency fan tokens, as part of their capabilities that they have. And I think they provided some of these to Messi, if I read this correctly. But yeah, I mean, soccer clubs that pay $30 million for a player for a year, right, or more.
You got to monetize that somehow.
You got to monetize it, and it's jerseys, it's television rights, it's
exclusive content,
fan token. Exactly. Yeah. So, this is interesting. I'm not a huge Messi fan, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'm more of a Bundesliga fan, and when it comes to strikers, I think Lewandowski's much better. But interesting to see this this story. And, you know, thinking about it, given the value of an NFT is only generated by the sense of its exclusivity, and the exclusivity is only there based off of the fact that it has a specific crypto, I'll call it a serial number for lack of a better term, right? I still think, and we talked about this a little bit last week when we talked about the hype curve.
Yeah.
I still think that NFTs, for the most part, are not going to have the same staying power as other collectible items. What do you think?
I don't know. A collector enjoys and derives satisfaction and value from the possession of the collection. So, like, Michael, if you think about your extensive collection of music and how most of that is on physical media, right?
Yep.
You have a lot of, you know, that makes you happy. You've got it, you own it. And so that,
and I listen to it.
And you listen to it, and you've done the digitization of it as well, so you can take it with you and listen to it where you are, but you've got the original physical copies of it.
Yep.
So I think in some ways there are people who enjoy knowing that they possess something, And then there's also then a display kind of structure. So let's go back to Second Life for a minute. And, you know, you would create your house in Second Life and you have a shelf on there and you would have the things that you have purchased or you created, and that's something you can showcase and that you're proud of. So to me, I think there is an intriguing opportunity here. It's a little bit of a derivative of an NFT, which would be, can I showcase my collection of NFT so other people can see it and I can somehow share it while maintaining my ownership rights to it and have people ooh and ah over it. Maybe that's an opportunity. Is like, hey, let's build the museum or the collection space, the studio, right, for NFTs, and then charge rent for people to virtually have their NFTs on display and then go be able to go visit them and check them out from other people. What do you think of that?
Again, I think going right back to the Second Life example, I think the lifespan of the value is going to be significantly less than owning the physical thing that you know is the original.
Well, absolutely.
Yes,
and that's
yes,
going to
you may know that,
evolve over time.
Especially when you talk about NFTs, which are basically, you know, we've got this event that happened in the past, you know, a great goal scored in some high profile match,
sure,
or,
mm-hmm,
you know, a video of the very first goal that Messi kicked as a professional, right?
Yep.
Capturing that, well, that video exists and has existed for a very long time.
Yep.
The fact that you've paid for one to be flagged as, quote, the original, right? It's a digital asset. The original was original at one point in time in the past, unless they create it uniquely for that NFT. Otherwise, there is no guarantee that it is the original. So you're just buying a serialized serial number version of something that could also be available freely elsewhere.
Yes, but there's still that pride of ownership and knowing that you exchange something of value for something you perceive of value. You're now into the realm of, you know, what is that value? And the value is what the market will bear. And if I could get it for free, or I could pay for it and say it's mine, and I ascribe more value to paying for something and saying it's mine, or even off, you know, off of a time series, you know, it's mine for the next 3 months. Artwork works that way too, right? You might have 300 copies made of a special print. And
yes, but you know which one's the original.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I get the conceptual thing. I think from a hype curve perspective, to tie it back to last week.
Yep.
I think the excitement and value of NFTs will wane very quickly, for all these reasons. And I believe that based off of the concept of originality, mm-hmm, being something that cannot truly be proven unless it is created for that NFT, right, that the value long-term will also be reduced. And I've also read articles that some of the early NFT certification sites,
yeah,
have gone down, and now you no longer have access to your NFT because it can't confirm the originality of it.
Ooh.
And I'll see if I can find that article, some of those articles again.
That would be cool.
It was like, because it has to certify. And to certify, it has to ping back.
Well, and that makes sense. So, in theory, that's what blockchain's supposed to do for you, right?
Yeah.
And if the owner of the chain, which should be distributed, and it isn't, I don't know. I have to read the articles that you saw. Yeah. That would be really interesting to see how that operates, because in theory, a distributed chain should prevent against a site going down, and then therefore you can't prove that something is yours. Right?
Yeah. I'll find an article and we'll throw it in the show notes.
Yeah. Let's do. Last on that is my also brain goes towards fractional ownership rights. So when you think about a player, there are some other interesting things that could be done for monetization purposes on a player, and fantasy sports looms large here. and the notion of being a fractional owner for a specific use case, right? So I want to be a fractional owner of a particular player for my fantasy league somewhere, or I want to be a fractional owner for the lifetime income of that person who gets monetized and time valued of money into today. There's a whole range of interesting, very exotic financial instruments that could be created based upon players that are just like this and take advantage of the same construct. I'm sorry if my mind is blowing on this right now, but it's kind of like,
hey, monetizing fame, which is what you're doing with sports players, is a key thing for that industry. So, yep, makes sense. Yep. So speaking of, you know, shining a light on sports, you found an article about some cool light shining going on in your house.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not my house, but it could be any house, really. So Philips has been moving right along on how do you make your smart house smarter and faster. And this is an easy, relatively low-cost way of getting involved. So Philips is coming out with a number of new light strips and lamps and ceiling lights and the like that you can put into your house and then control with events and certain, you know, other aspects. We have a few in our home and I like them a lot. So that's why my eye got caught by these. And I thought it would be interesting to include it in this week's show, because for those that want a smarter home or want to get involved in this level of IoT, it's a easy on-ramp. So,
yeah, I was going to ask if you actually use the Philips Hue lights. I've looked at them in the past. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've known people who get the colored strips, right, that can change colors.
Oh yeah.
And so I find them interesting. I just mentally they don't go with our decor. I was wondering if you had them and if you had integrated it into HomeKit at all, or if it's just using the standalone app.
No, we have them in. I'm not doing much with the HomeKit aspects of it. I'm not doing anything like, oh, if a plane flies overhead, blink them blue 3 times or, you know, stuff like that. But we do have seasonal changes in the light, and because you can more accurately control the color temperature of the white light that's created, that works out really well too. You know, you don't have to change your home into disco zone 17. You can do some things that with ordinary bulbs you couldn't as easily do, and you can remove some of the blue light as you're going throughout the day and into the evening, and then have them turn off automatically too. So we like them, we like using them, so we have a few. I don't know if I'm going to get new here, and I don't have anything synced up with like a television or music playlist to strobe to the beat.
That reminds me of, and I won't mention what decade it was in, but I remember the speaker cabinets that had the lights in them that would blink with the rhythm of the music.
Oh yeah, the boom boxes, right?
Yeah, boom boxes were afterwards.
Yeah, they came later. That was our miniaturized speakers that had lights.
Yeah.
All right, so moving along, because we are running low on time, but we got good fun stuff to close off on. Michael, you found this interesting article about a company that does furniture and design as a service called Pancake.
Yeah, this is really cool. One of the tough things when designing a room is not only imagining what it could look like, but then filling it so you can really get a sense of it. And so what Pancake has done is, and they've gotten some new seed money to do this. They will take a picture of your room that you want to address. They will get a designer engaged. They will then virtualize that room, and then they will dynamically do a showroom experience of your room with various furniture, you know, in a working session with them, at which at the end they will present you with a link where you can then say, yep, that's what I want, order, and have all the furniture shipped to your house. So you see, you know, this kind of is bringing together some of the things that we talk about around AR, right? Of being able to imagine, oh, this couch would look good over in that corner of the room, right? Or whatever, but taking it up a level to the entire room and allow you to completely accessorize a newly designed workspace or room or kitchen or whatever. And at the end of the process with a professional designer, click a button and order it all. And I'm sure they're taking a little clip off the, you know, a little touch, a little taste of that that transition money from buying the furniture, as well as the service itself, which I'm sure has got, 2 hours, $200 of a designer session.
That's pretty cool. So,
yeah, I thought it was really cool. There's a nice little video that demonstrates it in the article, and I highly recommend people go check it out.
You know, we've talked about various furniture companies using augmented reality to help you envision what the room looks like. That would be a really cool thing to incorporate here too, so that you could play around with placement. So you're collaborating with a designer in AR in your physical space, and then taking advantage of the whole thing of like, okay, ship me everything, right? And your space is measured out properly, and you know it because the LiDAR.
That's exactly what it does, right?
Does it? I mean, okay.
That is the coolness about
that. I get it. Okay, that's where I wasn't sure, but okay, that makes a lot of sense, right?
Now I don't think you go in VR and experience it, you're seeing it in AR.
That's pretty darn cool.
Yeah.
All right, so we are almost out of time, and one of the things that I wanted to talk about next briefly is about time. There was another interesting article in the MIT list of interesting articles, this one from Quanta magazine, talking about time and timekeeping and what are clocks. And it was a mind-blowing experience for me as I read through this earlier today, dealing with the notion that really, almost anything can be a clock, because there's a measure of how entropy and heat are related to time. So they give an example of a cup of coffee. It could be a clock because you know how coffee is cooling, whether it's in your Yeti mug like mine or somewhere else. So that was kind of a funny little way to think about it. But one of the quotes says, a clock is a flow meter for entropy. And
I like that.
Isn't it? It's really cool. And then that the smallest clocks that can be created, which become really important for nanorobots as well as just for quantum physics to begin with, can be handled with even something as small as 3 atoms. And how entangling those atoms together and seeing how the heat is dissipated and and watching now for the ticks that happen in such a tick-tock clock occur. Fascinating physics and quantum read. Have a quick look at this when you get a chance. I think you'll be impressed.
Looking forward to it.
And closing things out for today, last article that I found, which kind of made me go a little bit of like, really? Here in North Carolina this morning, we got a taste of fall after a very warm summer. It's not fall yet, obviously, but when it's fall, a lot of people's thoughts turn to pumpkin spiced lattes. And apparently that's not lost upon the people over at Bud Light, who've created a pumpkin spiced spiked seltzer that you can get in a pack with a number of other tasty treats like toasted marshmallow, maple pear, and apple crisp. I probably, for one, will not be buying that pack.
All I can say is, ew.
But did you hear too about the Kraft macaroni and cheese ice cream?
Yes, and you know what my response to that was?
Let me guess.
Ew.
That's what I was thinking.
You know, just because you can does not mean you should. Right, we've learned this in many aspects of life. Why have we not learned this in like food?
Well, and drink? So you and I are both thinking largely the same thing. However, I'll bet you that there is a at least a modest degree of success here, because innovation in the beverage industry for different flavors and different different drinks is moving super rapidly. And in some ways, while I can't be a fan of this personally, hats are off for the folks over at Bud Light for moving fast into the seltzer market, the hard seltzer market, with something like this, because it might take off for people that want to finish off their day with a pumpkin spiced seltzer, a PSS instead of a PSL, because you know you don't want the caffeine at that point in the day, do you?
Maybe
you do. Maybe you don't.
Maybe you don't.
So, hey, well, let us know what you're drinking and what you think, because we are out of time, and we don't have a three-atom little clock here to tell us that, but we know we're out of time. So tell us what you're drinking. Tell us what you think. Drop us a link. Enjoy the Labor Day holiday for those of you in the United States that celebrate, and for the rest of the world, you'll hear us and see us again next week on gamesatwork.biz. Thanks for listening.
See ya. You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.